Welcome back to the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring national security, power, and intelligence in the 21st century. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command and author of Leading the Charge, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom. Also joining us today from IBM is Frank Strickland. General, I'd like to transition to some of the insights in your book, The Battle for Peace. You point out that true peace is not passive. It's actually a presence and an action. Would you elaborate on that insight?
Yeah, I think people fool themselves into thinking peace is the absence of violence. It may not be. I mean, when we talked earlier about the stages of instability, you could have simmering problems where you could see you were headed toward violence. And you have to work at peace. It's easy for us to not appreciate that because we're from a highly developed society. You know, we take a lot of things for granted. We take stability for granted. We take maybe for granted the durability and sustainability of a civilized approach to everything. But if you've walked the streets of Mogadishu or Port-au-Prince, which I have, you realize how fragile it can be. And given that those were maybe not the most highly developed nations in the world, they were still societies that after this period of time you would think could not dissolve into a Mad Max movie scene. But they can. And we should always realize that we should not take those things for granted. The institutions which preserve and promote peace have to be kept healthy and viable. Security institutions, the political institutions that allow for representation and voice, the economic systems and institutions that provide for our well-being, the social institutions which care for all elements of our society, give a sense of fairness and treatment and are constantly re-examining ourselves. America's greatest strength is that we always reassess our institutions. I think we have looked throughout history where, we had a constitution that made all men equal. Almost 250 years later, we are still looking at how we could do that better. I mean, the civil rights movement showed that just those words in the Constitution weren't enough. Gender equality, many of these things have evolved to a most fair basis in latter times as opposed to earlier times. Although the statements and the commitments were made, it was an ongoing process to truly achieve what we meant by that and how it's going to manifest itself. And I think that one of the things that make us great, if not the most significant thing, is this self-examination, self-criticism, need to constantly reassess. I think the whole concept of the Supreme Court and its look at constitutional issues is this ability to constantly reassess who we are and what we are, what we stand for, against the statement of what we are, the concept, the ideal, which is a constitution, which is more than a law. The fact that we make all our government officials, service members swear an oath to it, it's not to an individual, it's not to a structure, it's to an ideal, it's to a concept of what we're all about, our very essence, and our ability to say our reach should exceed our grasp and we should constantly be trying to make our society better. If we ever lose that, then I think we're in trouble. As de Tocqueville said, America is good. If America ever stops being good, it will fail. And so basically, you've got to try to seek the ultimate good, the ultimate truth, the ultimate, concept of what you're all about. That's what peace is about. Peace and the ability to develop a society that works for the benefit of all its members to the ultimate degree, allows for its expression and development. It's hard to do because there are decisions you make for the society as a whole, for the individual. So it's as we learn more, as we understand more, as science gives us more, becomes more complex. And that is a continuous struggle. So, the term of the book is the battle for peace, which you could say is the struggle for peace. The struggle really doesn't end. We are a constantly evolving species. And as we evolve and learn and understand more, we're going to confuse ourselves and it's going to become much more complex and we're going to have to make adjustments. We should be trying to make those for greater good as we go along. It's too easy to drift back. And I think that's why I say peace is a continuous struggle and is a continuous battle.
Let's return briefly to the topic of intelligence. In this ongoing struggle for peace, intelligence plays an important role in understanding the uncertain world as it is evolving. What are some of the changes that you see that need to be made to intelligence in order to better equip it to provide that service?
Well, I think that there's not a lack of capability in our intelligence community. We certainly have enough organizations within it. I would say there's a lack of integration of those organizations. There's a lot of parochialism, which I think people in the business understand and see every day. The ability to integrate it has been a failure. I mean, we're on our fifth DNI, Director of National Intelligence now, over 6 years, six plus years, which is confusing. We're still debating, you know, who has authority over people and resources and all that. There's sort of mission conflict or roles conflict, which you can see. So I think the first problem is one of true integration, true understanding. I don't think there's anybody in Washington that really understands the totality of the intel community and what all its component parts are, where they are and what they do. I don't think we understand the resources put toward it, you know, whether it's insufficient or sufficient. I don't think we even have a handle on that. I may be overly critical. I don't know. I just don't know. I think we have to be honest about how our intelligence in many ways has failed us in recent times. I think Iraq is a good example. I think some of the, you know, there are many things that happened that maybe should have been predicted that weren't predicted. You know, and I think Iraq, 9/11, we can go through the litany of problems and issues that the intel community could see. I think there are certain things that I sympathize with the intel community. I think the ones that we all know, the destruction basically of our human capability, lack of investment, the legal issues that go with that in many ways that have created problems. I think during the Cold War, we developed an over-reliance on order of battle kind of intelligence. Sort of, we became very mechanistic in the way we looked at things, and then it was harder for us to understand intent or to read it. You know, so I do think we have a long way to go in developing the kind of intelligence capability that's very usable. Now, having said that, let me defend the intel community in a certain respect. I think the people who make decisions, operational and strategic decisions, do not understand how to ask the questions. In other words, how to use intelligence and how to integrate intelligence into the decision making. Intelligence is not just the provision of information. Those that analyze and develop have to be part of the decision-making process. Like I said before, they have to understand what you're trying to do, what your intent is, what you need. And if you just get the question, I often think to myself, I don't know how the question was asked of, say, Director Tenet by the president on the work up to Iraq. And I always imagined that what would have been the answer had the president said, George, I'm going to go to war, and I'm going to base it on weapons of mass destruction. Can you assure me that this is a justification for war? Not to convince me you're going to find something and it's a slam dunk, that it's a justification for war. In other words, there's a big difference in that. The president is trying to justify a war that I think he had other reasons, my opinion, for doing it, I think strategic reasons. But if he's going to pin that everything on that, then that director of Central Intelligence, his obligation is to say, I can guarantee you this will warrant justification, or I can't. And so if you make that decision, it can't rest here. That's what I mean by involving the provider of intelligence with the intent and the level of decision making, as opposed to just saying, we're going to war, you know, I'm going to use WMD as an excuse, you know, can I find, you know, five chemical weapons somewhere that are rusted and I can justify. To me, that's what would worry me. The intelligence system needs to stop being a top-down organization. If you go back and do the forensics on 9/11, there was enough out there to know something was up. And so we have to say, why didn't the bottom-up system work? Why didn't the flags go off? Why didn't it, you know? And I know the answer to that is always create a fusion organization somewhere. You know, we'll create another, like I said, the answer to everything is more bureaucracy and organizational. That's not the answer. That FBI agent that smelled something tried to report it and she didn't get any attention. You know, the guy that was running an aircraft training organization that didn't have a means. It may be more process or mechanics or philosophy that's involved. And the intelligence community needs to look at that too. I always am critical and suspect of things that you have a problem and the solution is just organizational, as opposed to maybe cultural, philosophical process, which I think are important ways to look at things. So that's what I think can happen. I am not sure we analyze against intentions. We analyze against highly specific questions and requirements. And that, I think, is the biggest mistake we make. I was asked by Director Tennant one time, I wrote about this in my book. He wanted to come down to U.S. Central Command, and he called me up and he said, "Tony, when I come down there, I want you to brief me." What am I going to brief George Tennant on? And he said, when he got there, he says, "Look, I'm not interested in, I see all the analysis, I see all the intelligence, I need context." Said, "I need context." And to me, that was a brilliant observation on his point. And he said, "When I see it, how do I put it into context?" And I gave him 8 things. And these weren't necessarily things he didn't understand. If you don't understand Islam, if you don't understand the desert, if you don't understand the colonial history, if you haven't been to these places and touched it and felt it and smelled it, if you haven't talked to these people, if you haven't read these books, you won't have context. It's facts, it's analyses, but meaningless. And he had asked me after that to sit with his analysts that worked my part of the world. And they had some interesting questions. They were great. They were smart, brilliant analysts. But they would ask me questions like, "What's so-and-so really like? What is President Musharraf really like? And to me, therein were the key questions. It wasn't so much on what do you think of this. They weren't the sort of the mechanistic, sort of mechanical order of battle questions. These were more going toward what I think were the issues of understanding intent on other side of allies, potential enemies, a sense of the world, the context you need.
General Zinni, what are the 2 or 3 top books you would recommend to someone studying international security, international relations? And more importantly, what recommendations would you offer for reorganizing the government?
Well, on the books, I think, I get focused on certain parts of the world. I love history. I think history plays an important role. Ansari's book on Destiny Disrupted. I think The Looming Tower was a great book because I think it helps you basically understand how an extremist structure was developed and the way it works. Robert Kaplan's book, Monsoon, which I think talks to an emerging part of the world. And again, he gives a historical and cultural perspective, which I think is critically important. Those are the kinds of books I like. I like books that are historical and cultural and end up evolving in a way that explains the current society and the way it works. And so I think that that's key. In terms of recommendations, I think we have a flawed, outdated government system that we have to look at. I don't mean in its overall concept of, 3 parts of government and all that. That's tremendous and serves us well. But we have evolved into a bureaucratic system that worries me. Our government is too big and too bureaucratic, which becomes too ponderous, too slow, and it can't operate in a world like the one we have now, which is too dynamic and changing, requires adaptation and responsiveness. So in business, this would be a failure. If I had a recommendation, we need to fix government. Not since the 1947 National Security Act have we had a major restructuring of our government to sort of look out to the world and face it better prepared, better organized, better processed to do it, better resourced and more intelligently resourced to do it. We need that again. It needs to be bipartisan. When major changes take place, there are people who see it. Their ability, though, to get somebody to react to it in a significant way, it takes not just individual leadership. It takes tremendous cooperation. This new world now requires a different approach. We still have legacy strategies from the Cold War, even World War II. We have ponderous old organizations that aren't responsive, don't appreciate the changes in the world, globalization, rise of information technology, and all the other things that have changed the world and the way we work.
Well, General Zinni, I want to thank you for your time today. But more importantly, Frank and I would like to thank you for your 39-plus years of service to the country.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It was great being with you.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command and author of Leading the Charge: Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom. My co-host from IBM has been Frank Strickland. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.